Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to the first podcast of Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. The podcast is dedicated to the exploration of Thelema, Aleister Crowley, the New Aeon, ceremonial magic, and the occult. On it, you will hear me discuss issues of relevance to Thelema in a variety of ways, including phone interviews with people involved in Thelema or the occult in some form or fashion. The podcast will not be released on a regular schedule, but instead, whenever there is enough material to warrant one. That being said, there will probably be at least two a month, if not more. To keep up with the podcast, download the podcast aggregator programs like iPodder or iPodderX, and subscribe to the RSS feed. This feed, as well as the podcast's blog, can be viewed at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. Please take some time to view the site, post comments about the podcast, or email your comments and thoughts or suggestions to podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. All program suggestions are very welcome. If you have something to contribute to the program, please email the idea to me. I'm very open to the contributions of others. And one last note, this podcast will have occasional adult language and obviously occult themes. If you are offended by these subjects, please don't listen. Now that I've introduced the podcast, let me introduce myself. Again, my name is John Crow. I'm a member of the OTO, owner of Luxor Press, and have been a practicing Thelemite and ceremonial magician for 13 years. Within the OTO, I have held many positions on a local level as well as the Grand Lodge level. I've traveled extensively in the U.S. and Europe, and have met many Thelemites all along the way. I also host a Thelemic web forum, www.thelema.nu. That's thelema.nu. Now, I know some of you non-OTO people listening are going to think this is some kind of Caliphite propaganda. I assure you it is not. I'm a member of the OTO, and I support its legitimacy. However, I do not think it's beyond criticism. In fact, I guarantee that you will hear a good deal of legitimate, constructive criticism about the OTO. It is my opinion that only through open and meaningful discussion can positive change occur. All that said, this program is about Thelema, so you will hear more about Thelemic organizations and individual practitioners than any one group or organization. Because Thelemites love their books, this podcast will also feature a monthly book update from Magus Books in Minneapolis. The bookstore can be found on the internet at www.magusbooks.com. In addition to books, Thelemites love their music, and there is much that is considered Thelemic music. On each podcast, I will end with a song or two that has some relevance to Thelema. I have a few songs for the next three podcasts, but after that, I'm depending on you listeners to make suggestions or send music for me to play. I have no interest in messing with the RIAA and playing well-known songs. I'd rather support independent and local bands, especially ones of a Thelemic nature. If you have some music that you've produced or in a band or something of that nature, please email me. If I like your music, I'll play it. Also, email me a link to your website or your blog or somewhere that people can buy your music, and I'll happily publish it on our website, and so people can go and purchase your music. But don't send me MP3s or CDs or anything like that. Please just send me links to the files, and I will download themselves. I don't want to have my mail server bogged down by large MP3 files. Another thing I'm trying out is Skype. For those who don't know, Skype is a free over-the-internet phone call system. My Skype address is Thelema Coast to Coast, one word, no spaces. I can't say I'll be on much, but if you do see me online, feel free to call, and if you do call, I may record you for the podcast. Enough about the podcast, just listen and we'll see how it evolves, and I know it's going to be a bit rough in the beginning, but hopefully over time, it'll get a little better, and I'll get kind of all the kinks worked out. The next segment is a phone interview with Keith 418. Keith is a longtime OTO member from the West Coast. He has some very interesting comments about the Thelemic community and will be appearing frequently on this podcast. Please let me know what you think of the various segments by commenting on the blog or emailing. I'll introduce the email addresses again at the end of the podcast. Now, on to the interview.
Hello, Keith. This is John. You there?
Hi, John.
How's it going?
Oh, it's going great.
So, I was thinking about the Thelemic community, and I was wondering what kind of thoughts you wanted to start out with on the first podcast.
Well, I think one of the things that we talk a lot about is the issue of standards. And, you know, what are the standards? What standards do individuals have? What standards does the Thelemic community have for itself? And the sort of conflicts that go into the whole idea around standards. And oftentimes I'll talk to people when making criticisms of the community or looking at it critically, and I'll say, I just think my standards are different from yours. I think I have higher standards for the community, and I judge it based on those higher standards, and I see you as making excuses for it. And oftentimes people react really in a way that I think is really interesting. They say, no, I have high standards too, but then from the way the community looks, that's obviously not the case. The standards just are not very high, and if you're constantly making excuses for both the members and the leaders of the community, then how high can your standards really be? And I think we are constantly seeing people who make these sorts of excuses all the time. I'm looking at some writing online today, for example, and the criticism is all going to the members. Oh, they don't support this and they don't support that. Well, the members really don't determine the way the organization looks to a great extent. It's the leaders who do. And oftentimes, the only way people think that they can really be critical of the community in a meaningful way is to criticize the members and not the leaders. And I think that this is really hypocritical. Also, you'll see, you know, the leaders and the people defending them talk about how great the changes have been lately and how things keep getting better. And that's ludicrous if you have any decent standards at all. I mean, it's sort of like that Chris Rock routine that we talk about. You know, people looking for validation and awards for things that they should just be doing anyway. And people looking for praise for things that should just be expected.
I remember reading about a year ago one of the community leaders bragging about the, you know, that they had 6 months of meetings that actually started on time and that they were really excited about that.
Right. And so you want a cookie because your meetings start on time? They were bragging about this. They were boasting about it, saying, look at how great we are. Look at how far we've come. I mean, if you start low enough, even the most pathetic kind of expectation, the most pathetic standard that any adult would have as a matter of course, you know, become something that you can get on the internet and brag about, you know. One of the leaders I saw recently was singing the praises to somebody who'd rented a separate facility for their group. Oh, I didn't think it could ever be done, they were saying, and this marvelous person did. Well, how many Christian people would think that would be something that would be worth bragging about? I mean, how many Jewish people, you know, look at their synagogue and brag that they actually have one? This is something that just most religious communities just accept they take for granted, but in the Thelema community, it is a sign of just amazement and splendor and wonder. But how did we get into this kind of position? That's what I want to look at. Why are our standards so low, and why is everybody rushing to pat themselves on the back for doing things that any normal adult would see as just, you know, something you take for granted?
So, how do you think we got here? I mean, do we look back at, you know, is it like an individual's fault, or is it like the structure's fault, or groups? I mean, what makes you, how did we get here? I mean,
I think one of the things that's really important to do is to sort of remove the concept of individual personalities from the picture. I mean, oftentimes, blame and praise get attributed disproportionately to personality. It's like, oh, this person is really great, that's why we have all this cool stuff, or this person was really a loser, and that's why we're sunk in misery and chaos. But that sort of reliance on personality is very problematic. In actuality, as you and I know, because we've been in the organization for a long time, we've been in the community for a long time, the personalities come and go.
Right.
But the problems remain.
Right.
You know, there's been people that have seemed like giants in the past, you know, 10 years who are now gone and no one even remembers them. But the problem that those communities had and the problems that we have all over the country are problems that remain. So I really think that the biggest issue are fundamental conflicts about the ideology, not the foibles and strengths of individuals. I think this is very dangerous, and it's sort of a cop-out. It's easier praise and blame individuals than it is to examine ideologies. I mean, it's laziness, it's a disinclination to really look at the nature of ideology, which is, to me, I think, essential. And that's the problem. How do we interpret this? How do we look at the way ideology creates these kinds of problems? And, you know, you recommended to people that they buy the Claudia Kowalczyk study, which I think is wonderful, because she went and observed an OTO body for a year, attended events, attended activities, watched what she saw, interviewed the members, and you can see even there, there's a real disinclination to hold anyone accountable, to impose any sort of standard, and consequently, people are sort of battered around by the lowest common denominator and settle for very little. And I think that's atrocious. I mean, I think that's when you have that kind of scenario, how can you not have a mess?
Well, then if it's not about personalities, then how did we get here?
Well, I think the biggest problem was that a lot of times people can only approach the lemma if they approach it in egalitarian terms. In other words, their inclination is to sort of make a trade-off, to say, I will accept the lemma, I will accept Crowley and the holy books, but only if I can interpret all of that in a way that is egalitarian and sort of contra to any sort of hierarchical chain of command or authority. So it's sort of a compromise between the force and structure of the basic documents and Crowley's plans with this sort of egalitarian, everyone is equal and no one has the right to tell anyone else what to do, morality. And those positions cannot work well together. They clash, they conflict, they can't be reconciled very easily. And that's what the communities are really struggling with. On the one hand, they don't feel like they have the right to tell anyone else what to do. And on the other hand, they have this, you know, very, very straightforward, hierarchical, authoritarian, anti-egalitarian, unequal kind of system.
But
so how do they reconcile that?
Well, I mean, the Book of the Law says that we're all stars, the law's for all. I mean, isn't that egalitarian?
Well, if that was the case, why would Crowley have set up a hierarchical organization? Why would he have a structure like the OTO, which is in itself absolutely not egalitarian? There's no democracy, there's no equality. Crowley keeps saying over and over again that the idea that all human beings are equal is stupid. So, you know, people don't want to confront this. I mean, is he wrong about this? I mean, see, a lot of times people will say, oh, Crowley was just wrong, and the structures he built were wrong, and they need to be changed. Well, you know, that's fantastic, but if you believe that, but you have to come up with another model that's going to work. You have to justify it. You have to put the energy and effort into it. And a lot of times the compromise that I think people are making with the structure of the OTO is, yes, we acknowledge this hierarchy, we acknowledge this authority, as long as it doesn't tell us to do anything.
Well,
in other words, we will accept it as long as it's completely meaningless.
There's a lot of people who are actually advocating changes. I mean, adopting a Thelemic democracy model.
Right. I'm not surprised about that. And in a lot of ways, I think they're more intellectually honest than the people who just don't confront the contradiction between the hierarchical model of the OTO and their egalitarian belief system. I mean, those people are the people that I think are creating most of the really serious kinds of conflicts. They have a conflict within themselves, and they create a conflict within the organization. I think the people who actually say we need to design a democratic polemic organization, I think they're wrong. I think they're foolish. I think they have a very shallow understanding of Crowley's teachings. I don't really think that they're serious magicians, but I respect them intellectually much more than the people who are in denial about it.
Well, okay. Where do you think individual values come into this? I mean, does that play a role in this egalitarian conflict that you're talking about?
Well, I think that people need to do an examination of their values. I think that initiation in any circumstance is really... involves a great degree of crisis and presumes a sort of exploration of values. And what you see nowadays, because of this sort of egalitarian, everybody's great already, is that initiation isn't supposed to change people. It's just supposed to ratify and recognize that they're already great. I mean, initiation for most people isn't, I was this thing and now I'm going to become this other thing. It's not that sort of fundamental change. It's a recognition. I was great before and now initiation just makes me even greater. There's no switch, there's no confrontation, there's no problem with values. I mean, at one point, Crowley said the adept has to destroy his highest moral value. And this is in Little Essays on Truth. And people are absolutely astonished at having to see this and confront what it means. If your highest values, if your highest moral values, which Nietzsche tells us are our highest values, the moral values are the highest values, if your highest values are egalitarianism and democracy, then Crowley is telling you you have to destroy those values. You have to say they're probably wrong. There's more about this in Liber Aleph. Crowley talks about the bed of Procrustes, where we're all fitted to as we enter society, where these ideals create a bondage that the whole world is involved. Well, how are you going to free yourself from those ideals? People don't look at the ideals as being things like everyone's equal, everyone should be equal, equality is really important, democracy is really important. They don't look at that and go, maybe those are the ideals I need to free myself from.
Well, okay, so let's say you do that, and everybody has a different set of values and a different everything. Isn't that going to lead to chaos?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think that one of the things that Crowley points out is that not everyone is supposed to do everyone else's job. There's a vision that the European conservatives have of an organic society where individuals don't have to compete with one another because every individual has a unique place in that society that only they can really do. And excessive amounts of equality create competition and create chaos, I think, because everyone's equal and everyone has to compete for the slots that are there. Whereas if you take a look at it and say, hey, it's not my job to do every single position. It's not my job to make every decision. It's not my job or my role to, be transferable to everybody else's job or role.
But then doesn't
then
that...
you don't have any chaos at all.
Doesn't that challenge capitalism and the world economics that are currently in place?
Sure it does. And the bigger question is, if Thelema and the OTO and the Thelema community as a whole isn't about challenging modernity and modern systems, then what's its point? I mean, this is the question that I keep coming back to with people. If all we're doing is ratifying the status quo, we don't need to be here. The status quo can ratify itself just fine without us. If there's really no difference between the message of a Steven Spielberg movie and the OTO, you don't need the OTO because there's a new Steven Spielberg movie coming out every year at the Cineplex, and we're never going to compete with that. We're never going to have the money he's got, or at least not at the moment. So the OTO sort of becomes redundant unless it's somehow challenging to the status quo. And in fact, you see over and over again that people are really uncomfortable with something that does challenge the status quo. Why? Because their values are more in keeping with the values of the status quo than they are with what Crowley taught and with what the OTO is really about.
So do you think these people are they call themselves Thelemites? I mean, would you consider them a Thelemite?
Well, we all have to have our own standards, and this is what it comes back to. I mean, in a lot of ways, I don't want to have ideological litmus tests. I don't want to have to test people rigorously about their opinions or, make people afraid of expressing a dissenting view. I think there's ways around that. I mean, we don't have to ever do that. We can have goals that are objective. You talk a lot about metrics. We can have metrics that are measurable, accountable, realistic, set on a timeline, strategic. We can have all those things without having to make ideological litmus tests or judgments. For example, and I've said this to other people, you could believe that Kenneth Grant is right about Lamb, that he's an alien creature from another galaxy or some hyperdimension that's come here to give us an important message. I could believe that that's total crap and is not important at all. But if both of us work together to build a temple, at the end of the day, we have a temple. We don't have to have a battle about these, sort of ideological point. And that's the virtue of having goals. They can unite people that have different values and different opinions, but we can put those aside in a sort of pact template situation and create something that we both believe in.
Well, that's a really good place to stop. I think probably the next time we talk, we should talk about goals and kind of how that fits into everything, but we're running out of time. So I appreciate you appearing on this first podcast, and I look forward to talking to you in the future.
Well, thanks very much, John. I was happy to do it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, that was great. I found the references to Chris Rock pretty funny. For those of you who don't know what Keith is talking about, I'll play the reference segment. It's from Chris Rock's Bring the Pain CD, a very funny disc that I wholeheartedly recommend if you like that kind of humor. Anyway, here it is.
You know what the worst thing about niggas? Niggas always want some credit for some shit they supposed to do. for some shit they just supposed to do. A nigga will brag about some shit a normal man just does. A nigga will say some shit like, I take care of my kids. You're supposed to, you dumb motherfucker. What are you talking about? What are you bragging about? What kind of ignorant shit is that? I ain't never been to jail. What, you want a cookie? You're not supposed to go to jail, you low expectation ever, motherfucker.
Anyway, our next segment is part one of an interview with Bishop T. Allen Greenfield. Greenfield has been active in the occult for 25 years, is a high-ranking member of the OTO, and a Gnostic bishop. He's also the author of a number of books about magic and the history of magic. In this interview, we discuss Thelema, magic, and just what it means to be a Thelemite.
On the phone with us, we have Bishop T. Allen Greenfield. Are you there, Allen?
Yes, I am.
You've been a member of the OTO for 25 years, or I guess active in the OTO for 25 years. And author of many books, including your most recent, The Roots of Magic, 1700 to 2000. You've appeared on many radio and television shows, and we welcome you to the Thelema Coast to Coast podcast.
I'm delighted to be here. Let's hope that's true at the end of this as it is at the beginning.
Well, let's hope so. How you feeling tonight?
As ever is the way I usually answer that question. Most people don't want an answer to that one. They want to say fine, but that varies from day to day. So I usually give detailed answers, but probably not on a podcast, because by the time people hear this, the chances are it'll be different.
Exactly. Well, I guess let's get right into some of our questions for you. How did you get into Thelema?
It's a sort of a loaded question in that I'm not sure that getting into Thelema would correctly define me. I hate to be, being not a fundamentalist at all, a quoter of the Book of the Law, but in chapter 1, verse 40, I believe it is, it says, "Who calls us Thelemites will do no wrong if he look but close into the word." Now, I think that is read very casually by a lot of people, but it sort of implies to me, just speaking, you know, from my interpretation, that that might not be the best term to define what it is someone is. It's simply a term that would be acceptable, and I don't react to that in the same way if someone called me a neo-Nazi or an idiot, but it's not my preferred self-description. My initial attraction was to magic, the occult, metaphysics, and I would call myself a magician, an occultist, and a metaphysician, and more specifically in line with Crowley's teachings, I would say that I am primarily, first and always, a scientific illuminist, and that would be my preferred brief term as to what I am in terms of what kind of metaphysics I'm interested in.
All right. Well, then, how long have you been active in scientific illuminism?
Since about 1973.
1973. So about 31 years ago.
Roughly, yeah.
32.
It's difficult for me to even grapple with that many years, but yeah. I did my first ceremonial magical ritual sometime in the 1960s, and it was exposure to the Weiser first reprinting of the Equinox and also Israel Berghardi's book, The Eye and the Triangle, that led me specifically into the scientific illuminist concept.
Well, then what particularly attracted you to Thelema or scientific illuminism, ceremonial magic, and so forth?
There's probably not one clear-cut answer to that, because there are a number of different things, and you might call it the low route and the high route. On the one hand, the concept of bringing reality, that is external reality, or what we perceive as external reality, into conformity with will,
on the low magic scale of things was attractive to me, and I also wanted to see if that did in fact work in practice. And I found if you have the right combination lock, as it were, it does indeed. On a on what I would hope is a deeper level is my lifelong interest in epistemology, ontology, and the overall what you might call the great questions. And when I struck on a couple of different terms, they drew me very strongly. Scientific Illuminism was one of those, which is, not to be cliched about it, but to use scientific methodology in the broader sense of the understanding of that, that is to be systematic in the service of spiritual truth, because it seems to me that the modern mind almost demands that if we're to seek spiritual truth, we need to have some sort of a systematic way of assessing whether something is simply a blind belief, something I'm totally opposed to, or something that has substance behind it. So I was attracted to that. I was also attracted to the term gnosis in the sense that Daffrey John, or whatever he's calling himself this week, used it. I'm not a follower of his, but he sort of defined gnosis as the radical, direct, intuitive knowledge of the universe. And it seems to me those are the two prongs of spiritual discovery that make sense to me. That which is directly apprehendable by the individual mind on the one hand, and that which can be demonstrated to the satisfaction of others, that is scientific illuminism, on the other.
What would be an example of some scientific application or method applied to ceremonial magic or spirituality or Thelema in general? What, in your opinion, how could that be applicable to a person or a group of people or an organization? How could you do something of that nature?
Well, one of my big grievances, perhaps my single biggest grievance with all existing bodies of manifestation, is that while some pay lip service to the notion of scientific illuminism, I've proposed various experiments which would need some considerable effort and probably considerable funding, frankly, but which could either validate or disprove various assertions that are made. I find it remarkable that most occultists who are active and in organized occultism, and even more so individual practitioners, sort of the, quote, solitary witch, unquote, who accept the phenomena that are being asserted without any basis in a provable, reproducible form, it seems to me that we could take a lot of tips from the pioneering work that was done in psychical research by the British Society for Psychical Research, of which I am formerly a member, at a later period, parapsychology. A lot of the same type of instrumentation and a lot of the same type of experimental designs could be applied, for example, to the efficaciousness of a talisman or the efficaciousness of a certain magical ritual designed to achieve certain results. Other things that would involve spiritual states, a great deal has been done, for example, with Zen Buddhist monks in Japan and examining using current technology to examine exactly what state of their brain is in while they're in a state of meditation, especially deep states of meditation, with very promising results. The same could be true, for example, of someone who is doing something as simple as the lesser banishing ritual of pentagram. Those are something as complex as healing. Those are things that have been done with nature from chance to something that points towards there being an actual relationship between the intended result and the result. And I see very little of that being done.
Well, what,
my own life, in my own humble way, just by experimenting in empirical observation, I'm convinced that a great deal of the assertions that are made by magicians have merit. Why they have merit is a secondary but important question, and whether my empirical observations are any indication of anything broader than my own experience is very difficult to get at, since nobody seems to want to use their organizational facilities to poll their members in any way, shape, or form, or, on the other hand, to do actual experiments, although I have proposed this at the highest level in organizations with which I'm affiliated.
But what about the argument that people give that doing such scientific experiments and things of that nature, it kind of strips the spirituality or the numinance out of the experiences?
It's an interesting argument. I don't know that there's any reason to believe that it's true, but we can't know unless we try, can we? My feeling is that as long as we're not continuously testing everything, but rather simply seeing on given occasions whether something has validity or not, I can't see that it would interfere with that any more than, let's say, if you take a purported healer in a parapsychological context and do some objective testing, and then they go back to their healing practice or ministry or however they choose to describe it, that anything of the numinosity of the experience would be taken away. If that were true, I would probably say the subjective experience would just have to stand on its own merits. But I see absolutely no evidence of that in parapsychology, which now has a history of, 70 years, and in psychical research, which has a history of, 120 years. It just has not de-numinositized, to coin a term, any of the things that have been done, except things that turn out to be fraudulent or simply are disconfirmed. And if this confirmation happens, I regard that as just as important as confirmation.
Now, but how does subjective experience apply within a scientific illuminist method?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because that would be flipping over to the gnosis part of it as I see it. And by the way, I should say that I'm representing here only my own opinion, certainly not the opinions you mentioned. My OTO affiliation show, so I should, underscore that I'm not speaking for the OTO. To the contrary, the OTO is among those organizations that probably has the facilities to do some of the kind of investigations I'd like to see, and has been informed by me that it would be a good idea, but they don't. All that you really could do in terms of spiritual elevation would be perhaps to do evaluations periodically of people and see if they, in terms of our objective understandings of states of consciousness, of well-being and so forth, how well they're doing. For example, there is a ritual for invoking genius, which I believe in modern form originated with the Golden Dawn, the real Golden Dawn, not any current clones, and in turn has ancient Greek origins, for the invocation of genius. And one would be, I think, serving one's purpose very well to say that someone who is working with that to test them at the beginning of their route, and perhaps, let's say a year later, 5 years later, 10 years later, like any ongoing research, and see if they actually have substantive improvements by objective standards in intelligence, in perception, and so forth.
So there's actually objective ways to still measure the subjective experiences?
Within certain limitations. Obviously, if someone says they are illuminated, in and of itself, there is not anything that I can think of at the moment that would do anything more than tell you what anyone could do, which is the assertion which I would make for myself, but which I don't think there's any objective proof of, which is I'm not sure what it is, but I know it when I see it. But for the components of elevation, of spiritual enhancement, yes, I think you definitely could break that down into experimental modes, mostly in this case testing, and just as with anything else of a psychological nature, changes are accessible. There are all sorts of inventories that are routinely used on a day-to-day basis to assess that with people in a psychiatric context, for example, or various experimental contexts such as dream research, etc. No reason to believe that couldn't be applied to the phenomena associated with occultism. It certainly has been applied to such Eastern forms as yoga and meditation.
Well, you mentioned earlier Zen Buddhism and now just Eastern forms of meditation. In Zen Buddhism, there is an interchange between the student and the master where various koans are asked and answers are given and things of that nature. And that seems to be an objective evaluation of the subjective experience that the students are having, and the master evaluates results by the answers that are given. Do you see a parallel or similarity within scientific illuminism to something like a Zen master and student kind of examination?
If in the sense that if what you mean is are they both amenable to objective outside verification? The answer would be yes. If what you are asking is, do I consider them to be techniques of equal importance, that would probably depend on a matter of taste more than anything else.
Do you think the states of gnosis received in something like Zen Buddhism has similarities or parallels to other religions, including possibly Thelema?
If one presumes Thelema to be a religion rather than a philosophy, which is also kind of a question where Buddhism is concerned, and very few other things that are called religions would parallel that, I would say, yeah.
Okay. That kind of segues into the next thing then, since
I should say, mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're identical.
Right.
Very important to distinguish that different routes have different ambience. That's abundantly clear. The question is, do they lead to precisely the same thing, or in other words, are they different routes to the same end, or are they routes to different ends? And that's something that I think is an open question. I have my own opinion on it, but it's just that. It's an opinion. It isn't...
What is your opinion about that?
That ultimately they're the same thing, but penultimately I favor the Western system over the Eastern simply because the Eastern system tends to devalue the importance of the individual, which is a reflection of a devaluation of the value of the individual in culture in general in the East. And I consider the value of the individual to be very important in Western civilization and in turn in Western philosophy and religion. And I consider that to be extremely important. Of course, that can get out of hand as well, but I think the devaluation of the individual has gotten out of hand so often in history, both East and West, that I take a dim view of it.
Well, then, since we're making distinctions between East and West and Buddhism and Thelema and so forth, I mean, what criteria do you determine or do you use to determine whether somebody is a Thelemite or a scientific illuminist, depending on what terminology you want to use?
All that I can do, for the to be perfectly honest with you, for the most part, I don't dwell on that. If a person comes to me and says, I'm interested in such and such, and it's something that I know something about, I'll do what I can to, you know, to facilitate that interest. If it's something I don't know about, I'll refer them to someone who does, or if I don't know anyone who does, I'll say that. In other words, I think people should be allowed to be self-defining in that area within reasonable limits. If they say that their major interest is shooting up heroin, I probably would have something editorial to say about that. But apart from really antisocial or self-destructive behavior patterns, I like people to be pretty well self-defining and set them on whatever route I, to the best of my knowledge, think might profit them in that general direction.
Sorry to have to stop it there. I hope to keep each podcast between 30 to 45 minutes, and Greenfield's interview alone is 45 minutes. That's why it's in two parts. But don't worry, the next podcast is not too far away. Because I own Luxor Press, I get a lot of things sent to me. Most of them are really lame or bizarre manuscripts that people want published about God knows what. I mean, you wouldn't believe some of the things that I've seen. But every now and then I get something that's pretty interesting. And recently I got a copy of a magazine called New Dawn. It's a magazine from Australia about conspiracies, metaphysics, and so forth. One of the interesting things in it is an interview with the Gnostic bishop, Dr. Stephen Haller. I've got a few of his audio cassettes, and they're pretty good. Very interesting perspective on Gnosticism. I can't say I agree with everything he says, but it is pretty interesting. If you are in Australia or interested in seeing what the magazine's about, go to the website www.newdawnmagazine.com. Again, www.newdawnmagazine.com. We're actually getting close to the end of the program, so I want to remind everyone to go to www.thelemacoasttocoast.com and post comments. Or email podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. I do want to hear from you all. I want your feedback on what you think of the program. Again, if you make music and you think it's applicable, please send it. But don't send the MP3s. Please send links. If you do send an MP3, I promise you I will not use it. Also include links to your website, your blog, or places people can buy your music. And also, if you use Skype, again, my username is Thelema Coast to Coast. Feel free to give me a call, and you may end up on the podcast. The closing song is called Scarlet Woman by Chakra. I don't know much about the band. It was on a tape sent to me by an OTO brother in the mid-90s. If you know about the band, or are part of Chakra, or were, please email me. This is the first of three songs I have theirs, and I have to apologize about the quality. It's a bit sucky. It was ripped off in audio tape, so it's the best I can do. In fact, my whole setup is a bit ghetto, but hopefully over time it will be getting better. If there are any companies that want me to do endorsements for podcasting equipment or software or anything related to the occult, please let me know. I don't mind throwing a few words to support something I like or if it helps increase the quality of the podcast. Well, that's it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll come back for the next one. Again, send your comments. I'd love to hear from you. Love's the law. Love under will.
Of light, scarlet woman, infinite space. Had it entwined within her embrace. God of war, spouse to the horn. Abracadabra, light of desire, the promise of new meat. Within me dwell hell. Turn our eyes, our lust. Summon the fire snake from behind the veil. Within me dwell darkness, goddess of light, scarlet woman.